I'm honored to introduce our speaker today. Tina Claussen Kaufman has done something few of us have the courage to do, even if we have the desire or inclination. That is, Tina has taken the time and energy to write down her life story, as well as the story of her family and its hard immigration to Canada. The final product of Tina's courageous work, Immigrant Daughter, A Monument to Poverty, reflects Tina's spirit and fortitude. Like any good memoir, Tina's book takes her individual experience and makes it universal so that the story of the Claussen family struggling through poverty and isolation in Canada is also the story of every Mennonite immigrant trying to survive as strangers in a strange land. In many ways, Tina is doing Mennonite history of the best kind, recording her life story so that others might know what it meant to be Mennonite in a certain place and time. I've known Tina and her husband, Ray, for several decades, and am grateful that we've been able to reconnect through our activity with the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society. Tina and Ray live in Albany, a place they've called home for many, many years. They are both retired. They have two daughters, Pat and Lynette, and one grandson. Thank you, Tina, for agreeing to share your story today and for taking the time to write down your history for future generations.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. I will try not to repeat too much of what is in the book, but enough to hopefully whet your appetite. When my parents and their five children came to Canada in 1925, they had a Dutch name. They were proud of their German language and culture, had a Russian citizenship. 2 years later, I was born in Saskatchewan on a very stormy November night. I was their first Canadian. How's that for a mixed group of people? I was named Tina Claussen. The name Claussen is Dutch, and in my ancestors' home country of Prussia was proudly carved above the door of many households. In 2001, when my American husband and I went to Europe to trace my parents' roots, we saw at least two homes with Claussen inscribed above the doors while touring Poland, formerly Prussia. Had one of these households belonged to my ancestors, we wondered? Maybe not, we don't know. But there is a story here that begs to be told. In 1992, I had no intention of writing a book or to tell my story to the Historical Society today, In 1982, I started to work for the Senior and Disabled Services in Albany. My co-worker, Maureen, a tall Irish Catholic, wanted to know who I was. She asked a lot of questions and was curious about the information I gave her. She was interested in my parents coming from Russia, but speaking German, and having a Dutch name. Maureen was also interested in my being a Mennonite. She had never known a Russian Mennonite. After I told her all she wanted to know, she said, "You need to write it down." Our two daughters were in much of the same position. Who were they? They were full-blooded Americans. They knew their father's family and church, his language, his country, his culture. They went to see Grandma Kaufman, who taught Lynette to read and understand the Hershberger and Kaufman genealogy books. They knew mostly American foods, but I served a smattering of foods whose origins could be Dutch, like a flat, large, thin type of pancake similar to crepes, delicious soups like summer borscht, could it be Polish, or the well-known cabbage borscht and varenicha, which are Russian, and of course, a version of scrambled eggs called the rire. They knew the Kaufmans and the Hershbergers and played with cousins and second cousins. They played church. Patty wore my net covering to make it authentic, even though I had never had one when I was young. But what did they know about my heritage? They could not converse with my German-speaking mother. They did not know her German songs. They did not know their Canadian second cousins, but did learn to know their Russian Mennonite first cousins. A daughter of a cousin younger than our girls was bilingual, and she spoke of a coup. Any farm girl knows what a coup is. Curious, our girls came into the house and said, "What's a coup?" Their four-year-old cousin did not know English, the English word for cow, and of course our girls didn't know the German word. I wanted our daughters to know my story as well as Ray's, so I began to write an I Remember collection. You'll find the thick blue book way back there in the back if you want to page through that. It has everything in there. Listing whatever I could remember from childhood to adulthood, including pictures, maps, records from the Immigration Department of Canada. And I knew all about school, our only close neighbor, our cousins, the church, and all about farming and gardening. And I knew my parents' moods of depression due to poverty. Family records, however, were scant. My grandfather had recorded some of the births and marriages. A double cousin from Paraguay sent his family statistics. I remember airmails coming from Paraguay and the stories my aunt wrote about trying to prosper in the hot chaco. Her husband, my uncle Abram Clausen, died soon after his arrival in Chaco. My mother shared family history from her memories. Some of my memories include a heavy brass Russian-made wash basin that we owned and we polished with ashes. I had an aunt who inherited the Russian version of a Mennonite covering, which was called a hoove. She inherited from my grandmother. No, it wasn't made of white net, but rather a black, lacy, ruffled affair that married women wore. No one ever explained that it had religious significance. My grandmother wears it on a photo. My mother had none. I was told it meant the woman is married. They also wore wedding rings. When I retired in 1990, I could give more time to the project of recording the family story. I worked on making a book with paragraphs from the earlier I Remember stories. I started on a manual typewriter. Due to my impoverished background, I had never learned to type. I took a term of typing at LBCC when I was over 50. When I started writing, my older sister asked blandly, "Huh, what's to write about?" But I had heard that authors write about what they know. When I was a child, I remembered that my cousin's romance started when she was picking gooseberries and her admirer got her attention by tossing a few berries over the bush she was picking. That could be a story if I ever wrote one. It was only an idea that struck me as romantic. Joan Krupp and Lynn Miller were two of the first to read the beginning story. Both urged me to get a computer. By then, we had two electric typewriters at home. Spending our winters in California beginning in the early 90s gave me time to work on my family story. Then in the fall of 1996, just before going to California, we bought a word processor. I had no time to learn how to use it. I took all my reams of notes and information along to California, where I imposed on an acquaintance to teach me how to use the word processor. I was not yet engrossed in sewing fabrics into comforter tops for MCC like I am now, so I worked on the story all winter and finished it the next spring. It was not done professionally, and I knew it, but it was good enough. We came home from California in the spring of 1997, just after we had become grandparents. Many trips later to the Laser Quick print shop in Albany, and I had spiral books with a complete story on paper and ready to give our children. There's a copy of one of those in the back. Extra copies were made for my siblings and their offspring. I thought I finished with my goal of preserving history. But now Ray appreciated my efforts and started to talk about publishing the story. I could not allow myself to indulge in that thought. It was too big an undertaking, and there seemed to be too many obstacles. Although I was confident in my English grammar and vocabulary, my writing was not professional, my punctuation was faulty, sentence structure needed improvement. Some readers of Russian Mennonite history may know the story better than I do. Stories of immigrant families like mine were repeated often in Canada. My eyes were strained, and I never wanted to face the process of publishing. I closed that chapter of my life and let it rest. In September of 2009, Ray and I went to Heston, Kansas for the centennial of Heston College. Margaret Shetler, our PNMHS archivist, needed a ride, so she sat in the rear seat of the car to and from Heston. The subject of my book came up. Being the historian that she is, she learned about my story and asked to read it. Sure, why not? Before long, she invited us for lunch. She had already finished the spiral-bound version at my request had a list of suggestions how to improve it. From there on, there was little question that we would try to publish. Thank you, Margaret. Our neighbor, Margaret Dutton, a retired educator, also agreed with Margaret Shetler that the story needed to be published. When John Sharp from Heston College was our house guest later that fall, he read the book and gave us his amen to the notion of publishing. The following winter, which was just almost 2 years ago in California, it was very busy with reading, correcting, and rereading the book. Now Ray was fully involved. Ray did all the investigating about publishing, contacting potential publishers, the length of time required to publish, the style of book, the costs, contacting the authors, and careful preliminary editing. Finally, in the spring of 2011, we asked Lee Snyder to marry, who is married to Ray's cousin, if she would do the final edit. She graciously consented. Her work and the changes made as a result of that edit made the thought of publication plausible. We appreciate her professional style. Thank you, Lee, and thank you, Ray. For those of you who know the history of the Dutch Mennonites, you know that because of the persecution in the 16th century, many Anabaptists fled from Holland. Martyr's Mirror graphically depicts many scenes of torture and death by drowning, burning at the stake, etc. One classic is Jan Lycken's etching of Dirk Willems rescuing his pursuer, a bailiff who nevertheless arrested Willems. In 2007, with tour imagination, Ray and I stood on the banks of the river near Asperen in the Netherlands, where in 1569, Dirk Willems was burned to death for his faith. My people emigrated from Holland in the mid-16th century and traveled along the Baltic seashore to the Vistula Delta in Poland. The Vistula River flows into the Baltic at Danzig, now Gdansk. In this Polish city, there is evidence of Dutch architecture to this day. The houses we saw at the port were remarkably like the ones we had seen in Holland. In Gdansk, we also visited a church that had at one time been a Mennonite church. Menno Simons preached in this Danzig church in 1549. It was in this historic church that after World War II, H.S. Bender found important documents shedding light on 400 years of Mennonite history in Russia, Poland. Many tributaries flowed into the Vistula River before it reached the sea. The Vistula Delta was a lowland, much like the lowlands in Holland. Therefore, the Mennonites knew how to build dikes and drain the swampy delta to reclaim and transform it to valuable land. They worked hard to make a living draining land and farming it. In the course of time, they developed large tracts of very fertile farmlands, which were a great asset to this country. The Polish rulers encouraged this through various privileges and exemption from military service. Today, Mennonites are recognized in Poland for their important contributions centuries ago to the economic development of this region. When Ray and I traveled to this area with a Mennonite tour in 2001, we wanted to see my Prussian ancestral home. My maternal family was Unger. We wanted to see a home formerly owned by Ungers. Our guide knew of a home that had been owned by Ungers and that they were Mennonite, but dared not take us there because when he had taken a tourist to this farm previously, the lady of the house shook her fist at the intruders, apparently thinking that they wanted to reclaim the land. But we did see the farm buildings from afar and saw healthy cattle feeding in green pastures. I knew that a Peter Unger, who produced a Peter Unger, had emigrated from Prussia to Russia. More Peter Ungers were born to a Peter Russian, Russia, and my Unger came from a large Peter Unger family. She married my father, Gerhard Claussen, and it was Claussen and not Claussen, the surname I mentioned earlier. Prussia, for a long time, had been a good place to live. The farmers prospered, and we saw huge houses they had left behind. We also saw churches and the remains of cemeteries. We searched for specific locations and names of on houses or graveyards, but none were conclusive. Brush covered the tombstones in neglected graveyards. In the past 10 years, youth from Holland, Germany, and France have worked to clean up these old Mennonite cemeteries. There is even a Polish museum in this area honoring and preserving the history of early Mennonite pioneering and life here. In church, they adhered for many years to the Dutch language. Eventually, they spoke German instead of Dutch in their homes and in their churches. There are a few Polish names in the church files today, like Sawatsky, which you are familiar with, and Laskowski, and others less well known. And they adhered to their Mennonite faith, including their belief in pacifism. In spite of their finding a refuge in Prussia, over time, tensions developed. Prussia became unsympathetic to their non-military position. The Mennonites felt discrimination in trade, such as in selling and trading their products. Lace making was a Dutch art, for example, but trade was restricted. In lieu of military service, they were forced to pay taxes to support a nearby military academy. They were second-class citizens. They wanted to be treated as equals, but refused conscription. Restrictions were put on the amount of land they could buy to support their expanding population. Neither the Mennonites nor the Prussian government was content. So discontent grew among the Mennonites. Many Mennonites from Poland immigrated to Canada and North America.